Last Friday at the Wharton School in Philadelphia, I convened a day-long Media Future Summit of bosses and owners from throughout the media and marketing universe, all trying to figure out how to keep the lights on. What follows is an edited version of my conversation with our luncheon keynote speaker. As you face your audio device, he's the one on the left.
Alec Baldwin is a multimedia star, producer, and an activist. He isn't a powerful media boss, but he played one on TV. On 30 Rock, his Jack Donaghy was a besieged network executive willing to make any and all compromises for the sake of the bottom line. So it's pretty much a documentary. Anyway, what's happening here when Alec joins us is that I'm going to interview him about his hopes and fears for the media future. And for his podcast, Here's the Thing, Alec is going to interview me right back. I can't promise that this is going to be seamless or even coherent, but you will be witnessing some hot, hot two-way action. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Mr. Alec Baldwin.
Thank you for having me. I'm here, by the way, because I'm a big fan of his. I listen to On the Media, and I admire Bob, and I like how Bob gives them hell, so to speak, on the radio.
You are a great American. I'm going to go first, all right?
Sure.
All right. In the past 2 weeks, without even the benefit of a Google search, I have seen you reported on in the media 3 times. One was a Daily Mail paparazzi spread of you and your wife walking your infant in New York. Another was a scoop saying you won't be appearing in a film that a previous scoop had said you'd be appearing in. And the third was an in-depth takeout on your eldest daughter's tattoo. Now, understanding that celebrity, by definition, demands a certain surrender of privacy, how can you even sit here talking about the media without having a stroke or, at the very least, a grand mal seizure?
Well, there's the media, obviously, for people who are consumers of the media, myself, other people who, you know, I have a media diet of public radio and the New York Times and whatever online and the Journal and so forth. And then there's people who are subjects of the media for better or worse in whatever way, which everything you mentioned there is just, you know, some silly nonsense. But it's very difficult to separate my feelings about the media between the two. So, for example, when I lived in Los Angeles, I loved the Los Angeles Times. I admired the Los Angeles Times. The Los Angeles Times had, this is, and by the way, all this is opinion. My opinion. The Los Angeles Times, I thought, had wonderful coverage of Sacramento and the state of California. Their Sacramento page, their California pages was great reporting. And they covered Sacramento in a way that the New York Times refuses to cover Albany. And so I love the LA Times. Whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I read the LA Times. Right up until a woman in the LA Times wrote this scathing article about me in the paper, filled with all kinds of, you know, invective and opinion and so forth. And it's interesting how literally one affects the other. I sit there and I go, well, I'm not reading the LA Times anymore. I just don't, they're just off my media list now. You know what I mean? And it's kind of silly, I mean, in a way, but the two do contaminate the other. They do contaminate the other. Now, I want to ask you, one of the things that drew me to listen to your show, I mean, On the Media would come on, was your acerbicity, if you will. You know, you're a tough guy. I send people links to your piece about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I used to attend, and it was one of those events you'd be standing there going, why am I here, really? Why am I at the White House Correspondents'? I really don't get it. And then you did this piece on the folly of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and beautifully done, really smart. I said that he nailed it on the head. But this is a kind of a, maybe not a very strong question, but like, why do you continue to do what you do and be on that field suited up and observing the media when you could just go and teach somewhere and write books and not have to really be on the front line of it that much? Why do you keep doing what you're doing?
I don't really care to come in.
Seriously.
Seriously. We try to understand how the media works and try to figure out what's wrong with it. But, you know, I think everybody in America, especially on the Republican Party, believe the media is corrupted in any number of ways. And we don't necessarily disagree, but we institutionally as a program believe what's wrong with the media have nothing to do with what people think is wrong with the media. And a lot of that is wrong with the media, especially journalism, is laziness, pack mentality, the tendency towards stenography when covering major institutions in government as opposed to really hardcore journalism, and false balance, the false equivalency, which in bending over backwards to try to create objectivity with a capital O gives equal time to two sides that are not themselves intrinsically equal, like trying to cover the vaccine issue as if it were a scientific debate, like giving global warming deniers equal time with science and so forth, which has turned everything with the media's aiding and abetting every issue, including things that can be measured through science, turned everything into a political argument. And the world should not be viewed solely from an ideological or political perspective. Some things are just facts. And it infuriates me when some sort of artificial construct of neutrality ignores readily apparent facts. So does that help?
I was noticing how, and this is, you know, this crazy, loopy, maybe non sequitur, but I was noticing how, you know, Cadbury isn't allowed to sell their chocolate in America anymore. And they had to have a license with Hershey. And if I read this correctly, you can Google this online about how, like, you can get the pure uncut Cadbury as Cadbury's recipe dictates it, or you can get the licensed, you know, for cocaine addicts. This is like the chocolate that's been danced on, shall we say, by the dealer. You're going to get the less powerful, less good licensed chocolate that Hershey's going to do for Cadbury here.
What strange familiarity you seem to demonstrate with the notion of dancing on.
I resent that inference, Bob. I'm just a reporter who's done a lot of research. I'm a media player like you who just happened to do a lot of research. But my point is that, you know, would there were authorities in media that we could all turn to? You know, the Institut du Chocolat made a ruling about the purity of chocolate. Would there were an Institut du Chocolat for media, a place we could all go where people were really rendering hard opinions about what media is worthy and what media isn't? I know
so
that's tough.
So you missed the Republican debate then, because they...
they laid that out for me.
They laid that out pretty clearly.
Yeah, I'll play that back. But the... but I mean, in the sense that, like Huffington Post is a good example. Huffington Post is probably my favorite example of something that comes along. And I admire Ariana. And if you know Ariana personally, she's a super smart woman. She grows this thing and she sells this thing. And now you go to the Huffington Post and, you know, the videos of people popping zits. And there's an ever-decreasing amount of it in the aggregation world that's worth reading. But there's some there. And I go to the Times and I go to CNN and I go to the AP. And I realize clicks, clicks, clicks. And the media has become like my primary business, which is in film. We would sit there 25 years ago and a movie would come out with Arnold Schwarzenegger and someone would make some disparaging comment. You know, a bunch of people who just got off the boat from New York and had just carried a spear at the Delacorte and they're here in Hollywood and they make some disparaging comment about Schwarzenegger. And the producer of our film would turn to us and say, "Don't do that." And everyone would kind of rear back. And he'd say, no, don't do that. Or she. And they'd say, don't do that. Because when Arnold goes to work, 300 people in this business go to work on high-paying, skilled union jobs. Makeup, hair, drivers, payroll, accounting, location managers, on-set craft, cinematography, you name it, set design. 300 people go to work and make top dollar in Hollywood when Arnold makes a movie. And P.S., when Arnold's movie cycles out, and all the revenue comes in, and he's made $300 million in profit for Warner Brothers. $30 million of that, 10%, goes into a research and development budget that's going to develop the next movie you're in. So all of us sit there and go, you know, that's a good point. And that's kind of how what I think the media is like now. There's a lot of jobs at stake. You know, when I was at MSNBC, someone took me aside and said to me, you have to understand, no one's watching this station. a woman who was a high place producer said, no one is watching this station at all. She goes, however, a lot of veteran people who live in New York, in the New York area, who have children in private school, she said this to me this way, she said, have children in private school. We all have, well, we are veteran news people who have jobs in television news. We've all worked somewhere else in more serious capacities. We all have jobs here because Phil Griffin created his hocus pocus that, you know, with carriage fees and whatever, where we all have a job here. So she literally looked at me and she went, shh. She said, don't complain about the sets and the, you know, all your complaining about how you want to make your show different from everything, which we did. We came in and we said, let's try to do something a little different than your shows where all the sets look like, you know, Soviet police stations and so forth. She was trying to help me, and she did help me, which was, everybody there, don't rock the boat. We've all got to, and that's kind of what's happening. My biggest complaint about what's happening in media is there's a lot of jobs at stake. And so if you pressed a button and turned it all off that wasn't really worthy, you'd be killing a lot of jobs, I think. So, can I ask you a question now? Do you have a question?
You alluded in the first half hour of your last answer to... to the
I knew what I was getting into.
To the glut of crap content out there that, you know, Huffington Post has zit popping as one of its videos or something. Let's talk about the problem of oversupply, not of junk, but of actually wonderful content. It's a genius glut. And let's use an example, your very own podcast. Here's the thing. Your guests are predominantly major celebrities, Jerry Seinfeld, Julie Andrews, Paul Simon, Chris Rock, the beautiful and talented economist Joseph Stiglitz, and you are a very good interviewer. And the conversation gets pretty close to the bone sometimes. I mean, this is not just happy talk.
If they
talk.
Wanted to, yeah.
This is not late night TV happy talk. You get to learn something from these folks, apart from what the PR people tell them to say. And when I last checked on iTunes, your podcast was like 129, just after the Reverend Joyce Myers Enjoying Everyday Life. It is ahead of my podcast.
That's all I care about. I actually thought that was the reason you brought me up here, was yours might have been like 123, so you could just lord it over me that your podcast was better rated than mine.
Anyway, are you a poster child for the genius glut?
No. The podcast was the result of me... I find that even though I still like doing what I do primarily for a living, I don't like the lifestyle of it. I mean, I like acting to some degree, but the lifestyle of the actor, now that I have two little children, is incompatible. It's really tough. I'm doing a film now, and, you know, to go away for 14-hour days and so forth, it's not great. The show is really just about, on the most simple level, appreciation and conducting interviews with people the way I wish I could conduct interviews. You know, when I'm the subject, and that's just, you know, talk to them about what they're about, how they feel about what they do. Is it everything that they hoped it would be? Is it everything that it's cracked up to be? And get some honest feeling from them. So the best example was Letterman, when Letterman came in and talked about how he spent 20 years pushing himself to the top of the heap after he had failed a couple of times in television, and he dreaded that happening again. And so he worked and worked and worked, and he said he turned around, he had never been married, he didn't have children, and he almost had like a nervous breakdown, and he kind of confessed to this on the show. I thought that was very touching, you know, and so the show kind of doesn't aim for, but I think the one-hour format allows for more of that kind of discussion. Can I ask you one now? When you talk about the chasm, if you will, between people's perception of what's wrong with the media and what's really wrong with the media, you know, for me, one of the biggest problems is that we don't have a place where people can go enough, I think, to have that conversation that's meaningful. You know what I mean? Where there's some kind of a forum. I mean, here we are in a room to have a serious discussion. Hopefully we can be lighthearted about it, about media. But where does it exist? The things that you object to in media, or the things that trouble you in media, where does it exist the opportunity to remedy that and fix that today? Where in the business or in academia or anywhere?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nub of the problem. We've been at it for 15 years, Alec, and I think we've done a really good job identifying flaws in the particulars and in trends and in sort of institutional structural problems. And we don't simply limit ourselves to media. We look at government and politics and civil liberties and really the society as a whole. But we're really, really good, if I may say, at identifying problems. And we're pretty good at getting people all pissed off. And they go on our comment section and either they say you are commies or they say, you know, right on, because they're fellow travelers and they perceive us as just another political voice. And when you realize that you're trying to do a rigorous, vigorous, serious approach at understanding problems and their provenance, and then you're just being perceived as just another voice from somewhere on the political spectrum, there's a tendency to want to curl up in the fetal position and just kind of whimper. Because you're really not contributing to anything. You're just giving other people an opportunity to huff and puff. Luckily, things are so screwed up that we can do this stuff week after week. And whether we're doing any good, I don't know, but people are still listening. And my kid has like a 74% of attending university someday.
Well, I think that, you know, I love information. I love to read. Years ago, you'd read the New York Times, and then you read a magazine. I'll just use two handy examples. You'd read Newsweek and Time for the extended, more in-depth reporting, you know, by some point during that week. Or another magazine, the New Yorker or New York or what have you. The Atlantic, Harper's, whatever your political stripe, you know, you read something else for more in-depth reporting. And now it's the opposite. Now I read, now the New York Times gathers in a pile on my table in my kitchen. I read news online, and then I sit down at the end of the week and I read the New York Times like I used to read Newsweek for the more in-depth reporting of what's going on. I pick up old copies of the Times and I thumb through them for an hour. Or if I'm on a plane or a train, I carry a plastic bag filled with four or five issues of the New York Times that week. And I read it like it was Time magazine now for the more in-depth reporting. But again, I think that people who are very engaged in the campaign finance situation and the campaign finance laws, which I've been involved with that for many, many years and doing programs with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and Josh Rosenkranz and Bert Newborn. And most people who are keen on that issue know that where we are now is where we were going to arrive here, which is kind of either very partisan, extremist, wealthy people were going to fund politics but not want to run for office themselves. The Koch brothers don't want to be the president. That's absurd to them. They want to pay for someone else to be the president and tell them what to do. But now we have in Trump someone who is this I wouldn't even say extremist, but extreme in how uninformed, I think, in my opinion, he is. He wants to actually be the president. And that, to me, is the latest iteration of the campaign finance problem. And I think sometimes, because it's not sexy, because it doesn't bring us clicks, we don't talk about certain issues. And that's one example. I mean, the campaign finance reform issue is the linchpin of all the problems of what's happening in this country. Citizens United is the tumor on the electoral politics process in this country. But we can't really spell that out because people just, you know, turn the channel.
But Citizens United is what it is. But it could also be renamed the Local Broadcast
The National Association of Broadcasters,
Act.
Yeah. The NAB.
Otherwise, they'd have been turning off the lights long ere this, but it has funneled all this cash.
Well, that's what Newborn and Rosenkranz would teach us years ago, 25 years ago, was that the biggest obstacle to campaign finance reform was the NAB, because some affiliate stations earned, like, I don't think if I heard them correctly, like 90% of their annual revenue during the election season. And so they don't want that spigot turned off, you know. But beyond the romanticism of all the president's men and that kind of thing, people, they really do want the truth. The world is harder now. It really is. I don't think that's an opinion. I'll say it's an opinion, but I believe it's a fact that more and more people have to work harder to pay their bills, and they're relying on other people to do their jobs, the air traffic controlling, the banking, the teaching our children, inspecting our food. We live in this highly interdependent society. And one thing people are depending on is for you to find out what happened at Médecins Sans Frontières over there when they blew up the hospital? What happened? I mean, what happened? This country has killed a lot of innocent people. not you, not me, but a government that we elected blindly, assumed they were going to do what we needed them to do. They're completely in the throes of some other group of people who tell them what to do. Every president comes in. You think the president of the United States comes in and he's a murderer and wants to kill people? No, they sit him down and they show him the films and they say, no, we need you to see this because we need you to do A, B, C, D, and E, because if we don't, these are the bad things that are going to happen. And the president doesn't want to feel like he's not taking care of his people.
Hold on here, Alec. Are you articulating a kind of marionette, puppetry, Bilderberg group view of the world where events are controlled by shadowy figures?
Those are your very well said, by the way, words about the fact that presidents come and go and defense departments and intelligence communities remain. And when these people come into power, I think it's getting worse. America is, I've said this in op-eds I've written before, America is great in direct proportion to when we do great things. And America is not doing great things anymore. It's the government, I mean, not the people. The American people and the government are totally separate. And the American government is not pushing forward the agenda for alternative energy, which we should be doing. And the American government is not pushing forward the agenda to get us out of the Middle East, which it should be doing. But people can't, in spite of the fact that Ailes and his group have come up with a place for people to vent their spleen, people still rely on you to tell the truth. They want you to tell them what's going on. In my lifetime, the number of people who want what you said they want, an articulation of their political view of the world to medicate them with, they wanted some pre-digested pablum that Fox provides for their audience. You know, there is no liberal equivalent. Who was that? Alan Colmes. I mean, good God, that poor guy. What a thankless job that was to be the liberal half of that show with that horse's ass Hannity. I mean, who's a bigger horse's ass than Sean Hannity? He's the greatest horse's ass in the history of media.
Let me ask you a question, Alec. How would you characterize Sean Hannity?
Well, as they taught me in Washington when I went to college, I would employ the language of the 19th century legislators. I have the least amount of high regard for my colleague from Fox News.
Let me ask you one more thing.
Sure.
Because this is about media revenue and about the financing of news and information and the financing of entertainment and infotainment. They are all pretty much in jeopardy. As someone with a foot in both worlds, I want to know, which do you think, which crisis, the financing crisis for entertainment or the financing crisis for journalism, is going to have actually the biggest impact on the society, make America feel worse?
I don't know about feel worse, but I think like in entertainment, I think the next thing to crumble will be the bundling of television channels, the way we currently purchase television channels. And we'll get to a full-blown a la carte ordering of television. And you'll be able to call up your menu of channels you want piped into your home by satellite or by cable. And I don't know, maybe a third of the stations that are on TV right now will go out of business. Or they'll be created in some other way. They'll stream online. You know, you'll have some other presence, like MSNBC. I mean, the MSNBC may go out of business. No, I don't say that with any malice. But that's a big thing that's going to happen in TV in this country. There's a lot of TV now that skates along with this kind of packaging that they do and bundling they do. And they have minimal audiences. As far as entertainment is concerned, well, I had a guy in a car with me. I mean, this is your world. This is not my world. I make comments about the financing realities of media, just what other people tell me, you know. And I had a guy say to me that the Times is going to change radically in the next couple of years, maybe, let's say 10 years. That unless they get even more digital sales, you're going to have like a single section New York Times. That's going to be news, international and national news and business news, and everything else will be online. Entertainment and arts will be online. Sports will be online. Metro will be online for New Yorkers. And you're going to see a kind of a single section Times come out in the next 10 years if things don't turn around for them digitally, which is a shame because I'm somebody who I don't feel the need to apologize because I don't want to be reading the New York Times on a device I have to charge all the time. I'm old school, and I like having a copy of the paper under my arm and reading the paper, and where we're going to be, everything's going to be devices, I think, limits things for some people. But what do you predict is going to happen along those lines in media?
I foresee a sea of hurt and a lot of very disappointed venture capitalists and even more disappointed public shareholders who have been sold a bill of very bad goods by the venture capitalists who got out just in time. But at the same time, I think we're going to see an incredible amount of content that we never hitherto imagined would be available to us. It's all going to be paid for by investors betting on the come, and they're never going to get paid off. And at some point, the appetite of investors to fund this stuff speculatively will probably disappear. Then will come a whole lot of consolidation, and we'll be left with what we're left with. And I just hope the New York Times has more than one section, because I depend on those blue plastic bags to walk my dog with. This man is making a film in New York. He dropped everything. He came down here. He has not charged us a dime. He did it because he believes in the future of media. It was the most gracious gesture. I give you Alec Baldwin.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This has been an On the Media Podcast Extra. Follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our newsletter, and help us beat Alec's show in the iTunes Top 100 by giving us that all-important review.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.